Consumer Focus with Martin Newman.
My name is Martin Newman, and having worked in and served the retail sector for more than 35 years, I'm dedicated to championing the consumer and helping businesses to develop the best strategies for their customers. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Felix Farley, who is a recognised expert in customer data ethics. That sounds pretty complicated, but we'll dive into that in a minute. And artificial intelligence, which is all the rage, as well as being an ambassador and AI developer at Intel, small business you might have heard of.
Indeed.
So welcome and thank you for coming along, Felix.
Thank you for having me, Martin. It's a pleasure to be here.
I believe you've also served as the president of the second annual Artificial Intelligence in Business and Ethics Summit, which is the world's largest non-profit conference on AI, and that you're one of the youngest experts in your field and have a particular interest in blockchain and human-level artificial general intelligence, which we will talk about later.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm not sure if I'd call myself an expert necessarily just yet. I don't know what the qualification of that is these days. I think, for the most part, it's academic. So maybe at the end of my PhD, perhaps, but For now, I'm just.
I'm sure you know a thing or two, and probably a thing or two than more than both myself and various listeners to the podcast. So I'm sure you'll make a great contribution to the conversation. So let's kick off with how data recording has changed the way that we engage with customers.
So I think data recording is a centuries-old practice, of course. You know, you've had censuses going back for a very long time trying to identify particular demographic pockets and their specific habits when it comes to retail especially.
Yep.
But these days, I think, you know, the really kind of defining paradigm shifts have been in terms of profiling. You know, when it comes to taking account of a user's actions and their habits and mapping those habits. And, you know, you can use AI to map those habits, but it's really not necessary.
Right.
And, of course, it's a very broad term, AI, so I'm going to try and avoid using it as a kind of umbrella term because the reality is all computing is effectively, by definition, AI.
Right.
The only distinction these days is really a matter of machine learning, which is a very specific process relating to neural networks and the like.
What you were saying a second ago I thought was really interesting. You're talking about, you know, customer segmentation essentially, I think, is where you were going there, and profiling and behavior. One of the things that I think not just retailers but consumer businesses in general don't do nearly as well as they should do is actually understand who their most important segments of customers are and how they go about sort of building on that. You know, I kind of see the world through the lens of a consumer, and I talk a lot about customer-centric transformation. I think that there's a tendency for businesses to jump into doing things a bit sheep-like because we feel that that's what consumers want. So if we take retail, stuff like click and collect, for example, click and collect is undoubtedly a driver for some customers, but not for all. So I suppose it'd be interesting to, you know, to hear your thoughts in relation to customer segmentation, customer profiling, and, you know, how that, the importance of that in terms of when you're setting out your strategy and what you're actually going to do to deliver the right experience for customers, the importance of thinking about that in the first instance.
So I think, you know, really all it is, mapping and profiling, is a means to the end of personalization. I mean, personalization is, you know, the kind of extent to which segmentation is going. And of course, segmentation is taking a kind of demographic or even just taste-based compartment of you know, a given population, and personalization being the absolute end of that, I think, is really the aim of, you know, customer segmentation. But with profiling, it's difficult because, of course, you know, we have this information overload these days, and people are very irrational and very impressionable. So when it comes to profiling people to the end of effective personalization, AI is absolutely necessary. Because AI is evolving. So when you have this kind of adaptational AI, which is really the true definition of machine learning these days, that is when you will have, I think, effective engagement with customers through personalization.
So what does adaptational AI mean in real terms? Make it idiot-proof for someone like me who's not an AI expert. What does that mean?
So when you're talking about adaptational AI, what it really means is real-time enhancement of a given algorithm. Right. Based on an incentive outcome.
So when we're talking about personalization, you're talking about not only personalizing potentially content, information, and experience, but actually live. So adapting to the information that the machine learning is gathering at that point, which might be the retailer, it might be their website, it could be an in-store experience, and then being able to react to that pretty much at that moment.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's like... them taking account of your location when you know you order a product. If you're in Kensington, you're going to be charged more than if you order it from Southeast London. Mm-hmm. And I think the real-time adaptational AI takes account of your location. Well, not even your location. In fact, it takes account of your metadata relating to you know, where you're looking on sites for, where you've bought properties and things like that, which really have an understanding of your situational context.
Yeah.
And your living context. So that would be the example where you've bought a house online, or you've gone through the consultation online, and your location then has been, through habit, you know, permanently revealed to be a permanent transition from one location to another.
Mm-hmm.
And then the AI adapts your pricing structure accordingly. And you know, that is actually, I don't think, in the interest of the consumer.
No,
unfortunately, because it really just extracts consumer surplus.
Not the way you described it, anyway.
No, that's right. Well, unfortunately, it's the case. I'm sure you know already that even if you order, you know, baby formula from an iPhone 6S as opposed to an iPhone 10, you'll get a cheaper price on the iPhone 6S, and it's absolutely true.
Really?
That's called real-time adaptational price discrimination. And that is all based on adaptational AI.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really funny case, in fact, of a husband and a wife. And this is a case study we had at the LSE where I'm studying. Mm-hmm. And it was a husband and a wife buying baby formula. And it's exactly the example I just gave you, sitting right next to each other in the same house. But because of the different models of their phone, it was slightly differentiated in cents and or in pence, of course.
Right.
The price discrimination is not really necessarily the producer's fault. It could very well just be the third-party platform's fault. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Amazon, of course, has one of the most up-to-date algorithms. This adaptational price discrimination isn't, I think, endemic yet, but you can be sure that the likes of Amazon are on top of it.
There you go. That's not really something I was aware of, so there's a bit of insight. Thank you for that. Certainly from a personalization point of view, you know, I don't believe that we're anywhere close to seeing that or experiencing truly personalized experiences across the majority of retail businesses. There are very few businesses that provide or leverage data in that sort of real-time context that you just outlined there. Certainly Amazon would be one, but there are very few. I mean, to the point where, you know, the majority of retailers and other consumer-facing businesses for that matter, not just retailers, can't even send out truly segmented emails based on, for example, your behavior, what you bought, which channels you buy from, the content that you interact with. You know, generally speaking, it's still a very unsophisticated kind of mass marketing approach, even to that type of performance-led marketing like email communication. So I think there's a way to go yet, but clearly there are some entities out there that are doing things with data that and demonstrating how machine learning and AI can be a driver for that, but to your point, not always for the good of the customer.
Well, I think it really is, in fact, definitely not for the good in every case, because all it does is extract consumer surplus, and that slowly will erode any faith that people have in these great companies.
I want to turn now to the question of big data. I'm not a massive fan of a lot of the buzzwords that float around our industry, and big data as being one of them, basically because, to tell you the honest truth, I don't really know what it means. I'm much more pragmatic, and what I'm really interested in is insight, because I've been that guy that's, just to give you an example and contextualize this, you know, I've been that guy who sat in thousands of trading meetings on a Monday when I was a retailer myself, running online for the likes of Burberry and Harrods and Ted Baker. And I had more KPIs, more key performance indicators than you could shake a stick at. you know, conversion rates, average order values, unit, how many units we sold per transaction, traffic, dwell time, footfall, returns rates, abandonment rates. My issue with all of those is that they're really the outputs, they're not the inputs, and you can't actually do anything with them. So when my boss at the time would ask me, you know, why is conversion up or down? Why are average order values up or down and so on? I couldn't answer them because I didn't have insight. So I had data, I had big data, but I didn't have big insight. And that's really what I was looking for. So, you know, can you give us an idea of how you think retailers and, again, other consumer businesses, banks, food and beverage companies, you know, restaurants, automotive dealers and so on, how do they start to get about turning data into actionable insight?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the reality is that businesses really rise and fall more and more these days on a smaller time frame because, of course, you know, the entrepreneurial environment we're in is getting much more fast-paced, much more competitive, and it's all because of these kind of augmenting factors like AI. So, you know, when it comes to insight, really what people are concerned about, or should be concerned about at least in the boardroom or wherever else, is staying ahead of the curve and evolving. You know, even Jeff Bezos famously admitted that Amazon won't exist forever. Amazon will die. And
I'm not 100% convinced about that. But.
No, that's right. Well, I kind of hope it does.
I'm not really convinced either that that's a comment that he probably doesn't slightly regret. I think
it was
one of those spur-of-the-moment comments, but
It's also, I think, a very kind of honest comment, and I do respect that. Mm. But the point I'm making is that he's very conscious of this, you know, very fast-paced entrepreneurial environment where you have to adapt and evolve. And succeeding isn't serving the current market. Succeeding is serving the soon-to-come market, really. Yeah. So when it comes to converting big data into insight, really it shouldn't be about these absolute figures and the absolute differences between absolute figures. Mm-hmm. It should be about relative figures and trends. So you don't want to identify, in my opinion, this kind of quantitative improvement. You don't want to take it to a current and you know, backwards-looking scale. Mm-hmm. You really want to be identifying trends and then getting ahead of the curve and being ready for when the trend hits so you can hit the ground running with those new trends.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I mean, I think one of the challenges that consumer-facing businesses are experiencing at the moment is what you were really referring to, what I would maybe call disruption. So, you know, businesses that have been able to work out how to leverage technology to deliver, to empower customers and deliver better experiences, more convenient experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, the most basic and obvious example I always refer to is Uber, because I think it's such a great example of, you know, when historically, when you were, you know, if you go back 5 years ago when you were ordering a taxi, I mean, obviously you could do that electronically as well, but more often than not, you would find a phone number, you'd call the taxi company, you'd ask them how long it would take, they'd tell you it'd be 15 minutes. You'd be questioning in your own mind whether it was actually going to be 15 minutes.
Even I remember that, actually. Yeah.
You might be going on a hot date, you might be going for an important business meeting, an interview or whatever, and you feel out of control as a consumer at that moment in time because you don't know when it's going to arrive. When it does eventually arrive, you don't know how long it's going to take you to get where you're wanting to get to, nor do you know how much it's going to cost. And then along comes Uber, leverages technology and enables you as a customer to know exactly when the car is going to get there because you can see it on your app. You know how much it's going to cost you to get where you're going to and you know how long it's going to take. So I think it's a great example of, you know, the type of disruption that we're going through and why, to your point about thinking about what's coming and starting to plan for that is so important because you don't, more often than not, we won't get a second chance.
That's right.
And I think one of the challenges that a lot of established brands have in different sectors is that they have a lot of legacy. They have a lot of legacy technology. They have a lot of legacy processes. They have legacy organizational structures and sometimes legacy people and capabilities. And I think that they need to be thinking about how to do things differently in order to have the agility to deal with what's happening at the moment, but also deal with what's coming down the line.
That's right.
And I think that's pretty hard to do when you've, when you're trying to sort of work with the status quo terms of how you've always done things.
And even now, you know, we have so many data points to extrapolate with, which is what I'm really talking about. Ultimately, it's extrapolating and finding the trends there rather than interpolating with past data.
Yeah.
At the same time, we still really don't have enough certainty in our extrapolative functions. So it's a very difficult thing to do. And that's why you have to actually get away from the data and try and take a qualitative analysis of the world.
Yeah.
And that is really the essence of a great entrepreneur, people who can recognize the zeitgeist, recognize, you know, where the world is moving without these numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to just sometimes go with instinct, don't you, and your gut feel. I don't think I trusted my gut till I was 40. So for whatever reason.
You know, I wouldn't even call it the gut, though. Yeah. I mean, ultimately what it is you know, this subconscious of your brain, which is taking into account all of this data, much more so than any of our computers can do so effectively. And the instinct you feel is really the function of what we so praise in our computers, of your brain doing actually much better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can't quite put it into words because...
I think you've just done that quite eloquently. just in case you haven't noticed, by the way, to those of you listening in, Felix is from Australia. So one man's potato is another man's patata. So data is what we might know over here as data. I love the way they pronounce it down under. Do you think that customers or consumers are aware of how much of their data is stored and how it's being used? I mean, you know, there's been increasing coverage of that, obviously, in recent years. But do you really think consumers have any idea about that?
Absolutely not. No, I think, you know, there is a willful ignorance. There is a kind of apathy as well. A lot of people are also conscious of the fact that their data has been stolen for years. And it's not just corporate theft. It has been illegally stolen for years by all sorts of state actors. And I'm talking about, you know, back into the early 2000s. So a lot of people, and there's no issue with that really, because in many cases it's, you know, ensured our security, especially in times of crisis. But the point being made is that if your privacy has already been violated, you know, once the principle is broken, that's when apathy arises, you know. If it's already being harvested, then who really cares? And a lot of people, I think, have a suspicion that these big companies, Google and Facebook, and Apple, of course, and Amazon, are really going to great extents to harvest all of our data indiscriminately and extrajudicially. I mean, it's not a legal process to do what they've revealed they've done, especially when it comes to illegal voice recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure many people are familiar with the very kind of concerning phenomenon where you might be talking about a certain product with your friends and then, you know, a couple of minutes later you'll find that ad on your phone, which means that there is this 24/7 audio surveillance going on the part of advertisers.
You really believe that? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think if you look into your terms and conditions, you'll find that you've agreed to it. And that's obviously the real issue, is that people don't have the attention span because of this information overload, because of their impatience, because of their kind of consumer mindset, that they just want to be served, that they tap the accept without reading through. And it is, I mean, I suppose you could call it necessary to have such legalistic, you know, I suppose specificity with such length in their terms and conditions. But I think one of the greatest imperatives to adapt to the very short attention spans of today's consumers is to make sure the terms and conditions are bullet pointed in very clear terms as to what data is being taken.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reality is the data that's being stored and used is not being, I think, sufficiently managed. You know, you have, in terms of protecting the privacy of the people, because you have both intentional violations of this data storage, and you also have unintentional theft of data, of course. Not least to mention the case of, you know, Facebook is the most obvious, Cambridge Analytica scandal. And there was also, I believe, back in 2014, I think it was eBay, lost the, you know, the names, the addresses.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been quite a few cases happened there over the last few years.
A crazy amount.
Yeah.
So that is a question of data storage. I mean, there are great companies out there like Global Switch, which have, you know, impeccable security with their, which is a Rubin Brothers company.
So maybe just on that note, if you don't mind, if I can interject, you know, because that might help answer or start to answer the or segue into the next point, which is about what can businesses do to ensure that their use of individual data or data is ethical?
So I think if you want to have an ethical way about you with data, you really need to abide by the law first and foremost. Mm-hmm. I mean, the GDPR is an excellent piece of legislation.
It's there for a reason, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And I can guarantee you, if Britain ends up leaving the EU, which sounds like they probably won't, they're going to copy that almost word for word because it was so well written, especially when it comes to Article 15 and, you know, these rights of access. I think they're really, really quite empowering for the consumer. And, you know, it's not a monopoly that the government should have on ethics. And I think more and more today we're seeing, especially with the, you know, the kind of climate activism of these particular companies like Telstra even taking a very specific response to terrorism in Australia. You're getting this more kind of socially conscious ethos about big companies. But in a large respect, ethics is, it's a jurist's job. You know, it's legalistic. And that's why I think the government were really well, so well informed, and the EU, really, I'm talking about, in authoring Article 15 especially. So, yeah, I think it's a very impressive piece of legislation to abide by if you want to be ethical. But, of course, you can't outsource your compassion. You can't outsource your ethics and just say, well, the government sorted it out.
I think that's a very good point. And I think also in relation to the world that we are moving, you know, moving into, or the world that we're becoming. I mean, if you look at the young Swedish lady, I think it's Greta, who started this whole, climate change movement, you know, I think is really quite telling and a great insight into the mind of younger people and younger consumers who are consumers today and are certainly influencing where their parents purchase, even when they're not buying themselves. And, you know, I mean, it's hugely important, I think, for all consumer-facing businesses to recognise, not from just from a commercial point of view, the impact of not doing the right thing, but fundamentally for the future of Greta, her children and her children's children. And that's the stand that she's taking right now. So I think the whole element of, you know, the ethical element of data along with social responsibility and a sense of purpose and the culture of the business, I think all these things are going to take on significance like consumer businesses have never had to think about previously. And in a way, GDPR was just the start of that, really.
I hope so. I certainly hope so. But I think, like I said, it can't be the end of business ethics. It can't just be seen as this, you know, forever protective spectre. The reality is that, you know, when you're a massive company, you have big legal teams and any piece of legislation down to the, you know, imperfections of human language will always be able to take advantage of semantics. And that is where they need to be ethical beyond legislation. They cannot be taking advantage of these laws to the extent of such ridiculous semantics as, for instance, interpreting unlimited money spending as unlimited free speech, as the famous US case in 2011 brought us.
Okay. Just moving on now to what customers can do about getting access to their data. I had the privilege in 2015 of sharing a stage at the World Retail Congress in Rome with a young man called Sir Tim Berners-Lee, you may have heard of, the inventor of the World Wide Web, and we've just celebrated the 30th anniversary of Sir Tim Berners-Lee inventing the World Wide Web in 1989. So going back to the fact that I had the privilege of sharing a stage with him in 2015, one of the questions he got was really around what's going to happen next. And he actually talked at that time about consumers basically being able to request their data and, you know, essentially ask for it back. Yeah. So can you give us an idea with your experience or your insight of what customers, what consumers can do when it comes to requesting getting access to their data?
Well, if you're under the mandate of the GDPR, then, you know, which all of the European Union is, then you have fantastic rights, like I said. And especially, I'll bring it back to Article 15. Within Article 15 and also outside of Article 15, ultimately you have about 8 central rights. And, you know, first and foremost is the right to access, in my opinion. So you can retrieve data that has been kept on you. You can also receive situational data, contextual data, so metadata. And, you know, you have all sorts of other rights. There are 8 in particular terms, which I can't remember off the top of my head. But I know that another is the right to erasure, which is also known as the right to be forgotten, which in particular cases isn't actually, a blanket right to erasure, especially if you've done something criminal. And at the same time, you have, you know, the right to, I believe, if you want to know the source of your data that the companies revealed to you through the right to access, and they aren't the source themselves. They have to reveal that source. And
do you think that consumers are aware of all of these options that are open to them at the moment?
I think they absolutely are. And one of the saddest things, one of the most frustrating things is that even though they're aware and even though so many consumers have acted on, especially the right to access, just seeking a record of what data has been kept on you, these massive tech oligarchs are oligopolists, I should say, are always, well, maybe not, but are always actually denying them this right still. So, you know, Google was just hit by the CNIL, which is a big French regulatory body, with a 50 million euro.
Fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was because they weren't responding within a month of users' request per Article 15 of their right to access data records in full.
Right.
And, you know,
that's got to hurt, surely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's massive, of course. Yeah. And the limit for GDPR regulation violation fines is, I think it's 20 million euros or it's 4% of turnover. Now, for, you know, Apple and Google and Facebook and whatever, I mean, 4% of turnover is billions. And when you look at a 50 million euro fine for Google, that's it's like 1/600th of revenue, you know. So, you know, it's not as effective. And as much as it's a beautifully written piece of legislation, it needs heavy-handed enforcement.
That's one fine, presumably, if they, reoffend or that those types of issues reoccur on a regular basis, then that's going to add up. And 50 million is still 50 million. I appreciate it's maybe a drop in the ocean in terms of the overall profitability, but
it's also a fantastic precedent.
Yeah.
So I think that's the really important thing. And in all of the articles I've been reading about this prosecution, they've been saying this will be called the Google precedent in terms of GDPR violations.
Interesting. How do you see artificial intelligence transforming the way we engage with our customer data and with customers? So we kind of touched on that a little bit earlier, but can you give me your perspective on that?
Sure. So, you know, we did really touch on the essence of it before. And like I said, when you talk about artificial intelligence, the only thing of relevance to talk about now as distinct from big data or conventional kind of, you know, compartmentalization schemes is machine learning. So machine learning is, as mentioned before, the adaptational kind of personalization means. So how do I think AI will really impact the marketing process? I think it's going to be about not just mapping demographics, not just mapping types of users. It's going to, and not just about profiling. It's going to be about live, you know, real-time tracking of everything a person does. And because ultimately, when we talk about marketing, we're talking about how Facebook and Google serve people because, you know, they are the third party that everyone uses to advertise, to market, really. So when you look at what access they have to data, the varieties of data they have access to, they could literally have a living model of you, you know, as a simulation within a computer. And follow the really slightest of details of what you do, because you do agree to these things in your terms and conditions.
You mentioned that, I suppose to some extent we've started that journey in the context that although there are very few businesses that are doing this at the moment, what I would call proximity marketing. So you mentioned earlier about getting a message on your phone that's contextualized to what you were just talking about with your friends, for example, some kind of offer that was relating to that because someone's been listening in to your conversation. I think what we will see a lot more of, I anticipate in the next few years, is when, you know, for example, you're in the environment of a store or a restaurant, whatever it happens to be, that you will receive contextualized offers and incentives based on who you are and the fact that you're there. So I think that starting that move towards that sort of, you know, real-time personalization that you talk about. You know, for example, in retail stores, leveraging beacons, it could be beacons or it could be another type of technology, but to identify where you are in the store, maybe through the fact that you've logged into the Wi-Fi so they know who you are and they can see your order history and that there's some algorithms going on in the background that are going to very quickly offer you up some contextualized incentives based on who you are and where you are in the store and what you're looking at.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know what, that already happens to some degree in Whole Foods. And, you know, Amazon is piloting in California a number of those kind of in-store tracking programs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even more significant, I think, in terms of how AI will impact, you know, engagement with customers, is this idea that if they can identify what type of consumer you are, they can identify what type of things you will like next, what your kind of chain attraction is, what type of consumer you'll become. And if they can do that, they can also shape what type of consumer you'll become.
Mm.
So it's interesting to think how they will direct you down a path of consumption, which will ultimately, of course, be the most profitable.
Well, Amazon, I'm sure you've heard this, but Amazon have talked about the fact that they're going to, they believe in the very near future, and I mean the very near future, they are going to actually start sending consumers products before they've actually ordered them.
Yeah.
Because they believe they have that much insight into being able to predict what it is you're going to want to order.
That's a perfect example, yeah.
Yeah.
So they'll send you a sample, and they won't charge you for it, of course.
Yeah.
But they'll just try and get you hooked because they know that your profile is that of the variety which would get hooked.
Mm.
So I'm not surprised. That's a perfect example of that.
Do you find that businesses are taking a different approach to how they apply information off the back of the studies in artificial intelligence? Are they that clever yet?
Look, I don't think businesses are altogether. I think universities... When it comes to management departments, they're very much having a revolution in their academia. And as also when you talk about places like McKinsey, has done a fantastic job of encapsulating the, you know, the paradigm shift going on. But businesses altogether, they, I think, have insufficient in-house understanding. And they shouldn't just rely on these third parties for their understanding of AI. Ultimately, there is this uneven field on the supply side of AI where very few companies have access to these data streams which are required to develop in-house AI.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to rely on these third-party companies like Facebook and Google, especially actually Google, Microsoft and Amazon. And because they're developing AI as a service rather than just being an advertising company.
Right.
Like
so you think Facebook. that let's say consumer-facing businesses need to take control of that themselves.
Absolutely.
Within the business.
Well, this is the thing. That actually requires quite a platform, quite a revolution as to suggest that there should be a wholesale data marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually something I'm working on. Rather than ever aspiring to be an expert, really first and foremost, what I want to be is an entrepreneur. And this foremost entrepreneurial ambition of mine is to make a platform that does this, which is... It levels the supply side of the AI market because, of course, it gives access to all of these different companies to buy wholesale the relevant aggregated data products that they need to develop in-house AI,
mm-hmm.
and thereby relinquish themselves from, you know, what will ultimately be kind of very expensive third-party reliance,
mm-hmm.
And also relinquish themselves from these third parties in a way that gives them privacy with their data because, you know, as Amazon has demonstrated, they don't only give you the service of using their platform, they'll steal your data. They'll identify who are the most promising come-up producers, and then they'll copy what they do and take them out of business. And, you know, that is the issue with long-term reliance, is that not only are you losing on your margins because, you know, you're not, they have to make a profit, the people you're paying, you're also, at the end of the day, giving them a full understanding of how your business works, a full understanding of your consumers as well.
Sure. I mean, I get that point, but I think also for marketplaces and you know, vendors of any note, Amazon included, you know, I think you still have to have brands. You still, because consumers buy brands, you might consider replacing one product for another over choice, over quality, but fundamentally as consumers we inherently buy into brands and brand propositions. So I think that there's got to be there's always going to be a mix of both. I personally don't envisage Amazon or anybody else for that matter trying to sort of take over the world and, you know, rule out all the brands that they currently sell. I think you have to have a broader mix that's relevant to your customer base.
Sure, but I mean, you can equally have these kind of monolithic conglomerates which have a million brands beneath them. So you give this illusion of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Johnson & Johnson is a perfect example, or Unilever even. So you can still have brand differentiation through single ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I suppose what is by great distance of single ownership.
Yep.
Yeah.
What for you, let's talk about the technology for a second in relation to customers. What for you is the most exciting thing that technology could bring to customers? So let's take any of the negativity off the table and let's think about what's the benefit.
I will tell you right now, my foremost concern is exactly that platform I just mentioned, which I think is, I hope, inevitable. And if it isn't, I suppose by sharing it on this podcast, it should become even more inevitable.
That's very brave of you, getting your idea out there.
Well, you know, I've kept this idea secret for something like 16 months now for fear of people getting ahead of me. But I've now really gotten to quite some extent with it. And I think it actually puts a hot poker on me to get up and move now when I spread the idea. So I invite anyone to advance this platform if they can, because in the end, it's for societal interest. So the idea is that you have this this platform, which finally gives us the data producers, this new commodity data. It gives us a return on what we produce. You know, we have people spending, I think, an average of something like 2 hours a day on their smartphones. Some people spend 5 hours a day on their smartphones.
Yeah, I have to hold my hands up here and say I'm at 4 hours and 40 minutes, which is...
I'm not surprised.
It's just a bit embarrassing.
I am probably something like that too.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, there's nothing embarrassing about it because it is now the status quo.
It's the behavior,
Exactly. And what you have to realize at the end of the day is that those are hours out of your day which you could be spending making money. Those are hours out of your day.
Well, so I would argue that some of what I'm doing is
money.
About making money.
So that's the thing. So what you're doing is labor in some respect. Mm. It's hours out of your day, you know, and your hours are what you afford to companies. Mm. That's why we're paid by the hour in various cases. But what I fundamentally think we need to recognize is that data production is labor. Smartphone engagement, which is what produces data, is labor.
Mm.
And you have a right to the return that the commodity, which is your data, is generated by. And I think we don't have that currently because, you know, people assume that when they pay the price for a phone, you know, the service they receive and, the utility of the phone, that utility takes into account, the value they give to their service providers, which take their data, they wholesale expropriate their data, and then... Not only do they, well, they don't actually sell the data, they just use it themselves and then sell the service of the utility of the data as advertisers. But the reality is you can copy data, and I don't deny that Google or Facebook or Amazon or Apple should continue to be able to expropriate data as they do, but you can equally copy that data, aggregate it according to like demographics, put those aggregated data products on an exchange, and then... Perhaps let the exchange take a 3% clip on the ticket for each sale of each aggregated data product to, as I said, aspirin in-house AI developers or market researchers or whatever it is.
So again, help me understand this pragmatically, please.
Yeah,
so this is about you as a consumer being able to get back the data that you've already shared
exactly
on your phone and in other environments and you selling it.
That's right.
To a marketplace.
This is fundamentally, I think, a very significant paradigm shift that needs to happen, which is the recognition of data production as labor. And to take a neo-Marxist critique to it, and I'm no Marxist myself, but he did make some good points, that is your surplus labor being expropriated, especially given how many hours we're putting into it these days.
Mm-hmm.
And if data is a commodity, which it very much is, more and more significant every day, there should be a price to it. And if there is a price to it, and you're producing it through your labor, you should be yielding some of that return.
That's a very interesting concept. So I guess we're going to have to keep our eyes on that because I have a sense that as a budding entrepreneur, we're going to find something live in the not too distant future that encourages consumers at large to essentially take advantage of selling their data and their data.
I hope so.
Listen, it's been a fascinating conversation, Felix. I'd just like to finish off with this kind of slightly alarming thought to some extent, all depends on your perspective, of course, which is when in this century can we expect to see human level artificial general intelligence?
Sure.
So in my mind, if I understand what we're talking about here, we're talking about essentially the robots starting to behave like human beings. basically having that natural general human intelligence that, that you and I possess.
Mm-hmm. So I actually, I've written an essay on AGI, which I think you might be aware of, and it's distinguishing AGI in my terms.
AGI, I'm not great with three-letter acronyms. Well, so for everyone listening, artificial general intelligence.
That's right, yes. Exactly. As opposed to just AI as we know it, or in other terms, you have superintelligence, right. Which is, according to some definitions, again, this is a very speculative field, so there's no really fixed definition. There's superintelligence beyond that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of predictions say that once we have AGI, it'll be perhaps 2 years until we have superintelligence thereafter, mm-hmm. which is, and you know, there's conflict over whether the singularity is this or that. But I actually, earlier in my life, wrote an extensive essay for a mathematics course I was taking at the time on predicting the singularity. And it was really simple math I did. It was pretty much just differentiation. Then it was extrapolation according to what I managed to differentiate. And then it was checking that extrapolated figure over. So I took the data from 1970 to 1990 and then 1990 to 2010, mm-hmm. and I differentiated a trend from 1970 to 1990 based on how many micro transistors could fit on a semiconductor, which is the general measure of Moore's law as the number of micro transistors on a semiconductor doubles every 16 months or so.
Yeah.
And I took the trend, which I'd extrapolated from 1970 to 1990 through differentiation, mm-hmm. and saw how it fit 1990 to 2010. Mm-hmm. And then use that margin of difference to then extrapolate the same from 1990 to 2010. I used differentiation again and then allowed for the margin of difference I had prior. Mm-hmm. And ultimately ended up with a figure that gave me 2042.
2042. So you heard it here. 2042 is when we're going to have artificial general intelligence. That's when the robots are basically going to behave just like us. So that is going to be an interesting time. Now, I need to do the maths and work out whether I'm still going to be around in 2042.
I
would
think
hope
you
so.
Certainly will be.
I would certainly hope so.
I'm only
53
well.
Today, so with a bit of luck, I might have an AGI looking after me.
Sure.
In 2042, who knows? Don't know about you folks, but I think I've learned a thing or two today about data, about artificial intelligence, and certainly the way the world's going. Some really interesting insight from somebody who is actually still relatively young, but clearly incredibly intelligent, and I think has a very, very good view of what the future holds for us all. So Felix Farley, AI and data expert. I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you very much. My name is Martin Newman. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Consumer Focus.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you.